Today, it is all about Iowa.
Candidates are making last-ditch efforts before the caucuses begin.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. In today for Jeremy Hobson, it's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org for Tuesday, January 3rd.
Well, coming up, the U.S. economy rings in 2012, and it turns out we're still making things.
BP wants Halliburton to pick up the entire tab for the Gulf of Mexico oil disaster.
And later, if the Walmart cashier doesn't have change for that $1 million bill, A, do they go to the bank, or B, do they call the cops? That's ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today, all the months of shaking hands and kissing babies and buying television ads in Iowa plays out before the rest of the country.
The Iowa caucuses are just a first step in the long nominating process, but it does set the tone for the rest of the race, both politically and financially. Wayne Moyer teaches political science at Grinnell College in Iowa. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning.
Professor Moyer, supporters of the Iowa caucus say one advantage of the caucus is that it gives less wealthy candidates a chance, that they can challenge candidates with deeper pockets because the Iowa race is more about meeting with people, shaking hands, that kind of thing. Is that true?
Yes, I think that it is. The nature of the state is such, but the smaller population and the less need for television advertising, which is very expensive, it does give candidates a chance who don't have quite the resources that others do. Particularly, say, with Rick Santorum, who didn't have very much money, who's rising very rapidly in the polls right now. And he spent, I think, something like 100 days in Iowa. And he would not have been able to do that in a larger state. He wouldn't have had the same kind of impact.
Now, Iowa has its own particular economy. It's got quite a low unemployment rate, and it's also a very rural state, and it's been a good few years for farmers. How is Iowa's economy factoring into the race right now?
I don't think that it is making a great deal of difference. I think the people in Iowa are sort of looking at the national situation as much as they're looking at the Iowa situation. I mean, we still have an unemployment rate of 6%, which is still pretty high. I haven't been able to tell how that it's helping candidates or hurting candidates, per se.
Wayne Moyer is a professor of political science at Grinnell College in Iowa. Professor Moyer, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, on this day that voters in the Hawkeye State are caucusing with their neighbors, we decided to do, Stacey, a little investigating.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In today's Midday Extra, we ask, what are the Iowa caucuses really, really, really like? Here to talk with us is Chris Larimer. He's a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa. He would know what these caucuses are really, really, really like. Hey, Professor.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us today. You know, I want you to set the scene for us. If we were to, say, be guests in Iowa for the day and we were to, say, attend a caucus, you know, we'd walk in the door. What would we see?
Well, you'd walk in the door, you'd see a bunch of other people kind of crowded in a big room. And if depending on the caucus site you're at, you might see one or two of the candidates. Here on the campus here, we have one site for the entire county for all the precincts. And Newt Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann are going to be at the caucus tonight. And so when you walk in, you'd register at the door, you'd come in, and then they'd have everybody kind of sit down, and each candidate or representative from the candidate's campaign would give a short stump speech trying to convince any of those last-minute undecided voters to caucus for them.
Not to bring the conversation to food, but about the food.
Yeah.
I mean, is it just coffee and snacks? Can you get wine and beer?
This is all a part of the, what is it really, really like, yeah. Professor?
Yeah, no, there's coffee. There might be some snacks, depending on the size of the precinct site. But yeah, there's usually coffee, something to keep people awake and attentive.
No adult beverages?
No, I think most of these are in public buildings, so I think they kind of discourage that a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, you can certainly do that before you go, but
or maybe they'll head there afterward.
All right, yeah, exactly, depending on how.
Yeah, many a bar will be open in Iowa.
Right.
Well, how do you get picked to be in a specific caucus? Do you get invited? Is it based on your address?
Well, it's like Google Plus.
Yeah.
Do you have to be in someone's circle?
Sure. No, it's completely based on your address. And then, and so in Iowa, we have 1,774 precincts. And so those, you each go to your, you're assigned to a precinct. And then if you live in that precinct, you go to a particular location on caucus night. And then you're selecting delegates. And the number of delegates you get is based on how many people voted in the last election.
I'm curious, Professor, because you've got so many Republicans who are, you know, just walloping each other for the past 3, 4, 5, 6 months, whatever the timetable.
Yeah.
And then, of course, President Obama is unopposed. So will the Democrats party a lot harder this year because he's the only option?
Yeah, actually, usually the incumbent party usually doesn't have a caucus. But this year, the Democrats are going to hold caucuses in Iowa. And I think a lot of it's based on there might be some concern in the Obama campaign about kind of reminding people and getting them excited about the campaign. You know, in 2008, they had so many young voters, and they want to make sure that those people are mobilized again this time around. So it's actually unusual, but they are holding a caucus tonight. I'm not sure what kind of party it's going to be, but they are going to have try to get people out there, talk about the party platform, and do some other party business.
I've got some friends in Iowa, so if I go to their Facebook pages, will I see, like, pictures of these caucuses?
Yes, you should.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So people will be uploading all the excitement in Iowa.
Oh, yeah. That's why I'm going to be trying to check all of that as much as I can tonight.
Christopher Larimer is a political science professor at the University of Northern Iowa. Christopher, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Chris.
You bet. Thanks.
Well, shifting gears now, British oil giant BP has filed court papers demanding the Houston-based Halliburton pay billions of dollars in cleanup and compensation costs for the 2010 oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 4 million gallons plus of oil leaked into the Gulf after a blowout on the Deepwater Horizon rig. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us now from London with the latest on that story. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
Now, why does BP say Halliburton should be responsible for this leak?
Well, Halliburton did the cement work on the well, and it's been alleged the cement job was defective and may have contributed to and perhaps even caused the disaster.
Now, how much does BP want them to pay?
Well, BP isn't saying in its court filing in New York. It doesn't put a precise figure on its claim, but it's already spent $14 billion responding to the spill. That's on containment, cleanup, and some compensation. And it's set aside a further $20 billion for future costs. It obviously would like some help with that huge financial burden. But Nick McGregor, an oil analyst with stockbrokers Redmayne Bentley, says BP's court action isn't only about money. It's also about sharing the blame for America's worst oil spill.
It's about the view BP have taken all along that this was a variety of failings by a variety of companies, and a judgment against Halliburton would vindicate that view that BP were not the sole responsible party.
Last month, the company that made the blowout preventer on the wellhead agreed to pay BP $250 million in damages. And BP is also taking legal action against Transocean, the company that owned and operated the Deepwater Horizon rig.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Ohio has temporarily banned hydraulic fracking in some parts of the state. That after a series of rare earthquakes, including one that rocked Youngstown over the weekend. From the sustainability desk, Eve Tro joins us. Good morning, Eve.
Good morning.
So, Eve, earthquakes in Ohio, that seems surprising. What happened?
It is surprising. There was a 4.0 quake. That's unusually big for Ohio. But state officials say 11 quakes have happened in the past year, all linked to this one natural gas well close to Youngstown. So they're pretty sure it's fracking that's the problem. That's when drilling companies inject high-pressure fluid down into layers of rock to get natural gas out. The industry says there's no proof that causes earthquakes. Still, the state has banned fracking, first at this one problematic well, and now at 5 miles around the well. That means 5 wells total are closed for the foreseeable future.
Ohio is not alone in trying to restrict fracking. How have other places dealt with the risk?
Well, fracking is going on all over the country, and there are many, many efforts to restrict it. Ohio follows Arkansas, Oklahoma, and Texas on regulating fracking near earthquake sites. In Pennsylvania, that's the state that's maybe made the most money on fracking. There have been efforts at a state ban, but those haven't gone far. Yet in the state's major industrial city of Pittsburgh, the city council unanimously voted to ban it. Now, on the flip side, in Colorado, the state Supreme Court just ruled that cities cannot ban fracking. But local towns there are pushing back. They're making drilling companies pay for tests of local water supplies. So in 2012, we're going to see a lot more battles over fracking. They're only going to get bigger in Washington and in city halls all around the U.S.
Our own Eve Tro. Thank you, Eve.
Thank you.
Well, we found out today manufacturing activity expanded at its fastest clip in at least 6 months. After a long and deep recession, companies have started hiring again, but they want workers who are more highly skilled than the ones they laid off. So they're turning to local vocational programs for help. From the Changing Gears Media Project, Nyla Boudou reports.
They are grinding and cutting.
Under the watchful eye of welding instructor Leo Suri, students are cutting through sheets of metal at Richland Community College in Decatur, Illinois. The school only has enough shop space for 12 students at a time. But this year, there's been so much demand for welding courses, the college began offering classes overnight.
We go from midnight to 4 a.m.
That's Richland's Douglas Brower. He's a vice president at the school. The college is building a new workplace training center that will allow it to more than double the size of its vocational classes. In the meantime, the midnight welding class is especially popular with workers coming off second and third shifts at nearby Caterpillar, maker of heavy construction and mining equipment. Brower says other local manufacturers are also looking for skilled workers.
Everybody seems to be in more of a hiring mode.
The jobless rate in American factories has dropped from a high of about 13% in January 2010 to less than 8%. But these days, manufacturers are looking for workers with sophisticated skill sets. That means not just more welders, but people with training in both mechanical and electrical engineering. One of the greatest needs is for machinists.
Tool number two is the 201 drill.
Symbol Job Training is a for-profit vocational school north of Chicago. It mostly teaches students what's known as computerized numerical control, CNC. It runs most machines on today's factory floors. In this class, students learn CNC programming. John Zawoyski says he hopes the course will help him get out of his current warehousing job.
I was making pretty good money in my last job. Got laid off. I haven't been able to find that kind of pay anywhere else, so I got into the machining.
Zawoyski hadn't heard of machining until a counselor at the local employment office told him it could be a good career. And that's the problem with the employment pipeline, vocational instructors say. Most people may think there just aren't any jobs in manufacturing anymore. In Chicago, I'm Nyla Boudou for Marketplace.
Next week, car makers unveil their new models at the North American International Auto Show. Cadillac hopes to make a strong showing in the luxury category. It's a different story for Ford's struggling Lincoln brand. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has that story.
Cadillac is well on the road to reinventing itself, at least in the U.S. After the success of its CTS model, Cadillac will unveil the ATS, which aims to compete head-to-head with the Mercedes-Benz C-Class and the BMW 3 Series. Aaron Bragman is with IHS Automotive. He says the ATS is Cadillac's push into the global market.
Look at us. We are a serious competitor for the established German brands, and here's the proof of it.
Still, making Cadillac a global brand won't be easy. It has only a small foothold in China and virtually none in Europe. But Lincoln should have such problems. Michelle Krebs is an analyst with Edmunds.com. She says Lincoln suffered from Ford's habit of buying other luxury brands.
They own Jaguar, Land Rover, Volvo, Aston Martin. They put money into those brands, transforming them, and Lincoln basically got ignored.
Now Ford is investing $1 billion in Lincoln, and the brand has its own design studio. But executives admit the reinvention of Lincoln could take a decade. I'm Tracy Samilton for Marketplace.
So, Steve, are you a gambling man?
I've been known to go to the roulette table or perhaps buy a lotto ticket here in California.
Oh, well, yeah. Then this is very pertinent. The price of Powerball tickets is doubling.
What?
Yes.
Wow.
So now if you want to chance the multi-million dollar pot, it's going to cost you
$2. $2.
Yeah. It's the first price increase in almost 20 years.
Wow.
Right now. But it's not all bad news. There's
really?
A bright side.
All right.
Your odds are better.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, you have a better chance of winning.
Well, I'll pay more if the odds are better.
Yes.
How much better?
They're a lot better. Instead of a 1 in 195 million chance of winning,
yeah. You
will now have a 1 in 175 million chance of winning.
Okay, it's either 1 or 195 million or 1 in 175 million.
Yeah.
So my chances decrease. Let's see. No, my chances increased by 20 million.
You don't want to try to do the math on
it. I don't even want to do the math. It gives me a headache, and it just tells me I'm still going to lose every time.
Well, let's put it this way. It's probably not the best idea for a retirement plan.
Well, the people who put their money in riskier bonds are hoping 2012 is a better year for their returns. Bank of America Merrill Lynch says it's the first time in 3 years lower graded bonds didn't do as well as safer investments. Well, bonds, of course, take many forms. Countries sell them to pay their debts if they can. See Greece. Companies offer them up, too. And Marketplace Whiteboard Chief Patty Hirsch takes us on a little field trip to explain how different bonds with different ratings work.
So you wanted to talk about bonds, Steve? I have the perfect place. Here we are.
What is this place?
This is a used auto parts center.
Used part? No, Patty, this is a junkyard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. See that rusted old jalopy over there? That is junk.
It's all in the eye of the beholder, Steve. You see junk, I see a valuable store of parts for my 2001 Saturn LS1.
Really? You take parts from some wreck that's been towed here and put those parts in your car? Don't you think that's a bit risky, Patty?
Well, I'd be getting them at a discount to what I pay on eBay, and they'd be way cheaper than if I got them from a GM dealer, that is for sure.
Okay, fair enough. It's your funeral, but what has this got to do with bonds?
Well, bonds are just like car parts.
They are?
Well, sure. If you buy parts that are brand spanking new from the manufacturer, it's still all greased up and ready to go, they're pretty low risk, right?
Right.
You'd be happy to put them in your car.
Sure.
Well, bonds are the same. Some bonds are super safe. They're sold by companies that are profitable, that look very likely to make their interest payments and pay their lenders their money back.
I'd be happy to put those bonds in my portfolio.
Right. So, but some bonds are not so safe, right? They're sold by riskier companies, like companies that may have borrowed a lot of money or maybe operate in uncertain industries. Companies like these may not be able to make their debt payments. They may not even be able to pay you back. Those bonds are like the car parts you buy from a place like this.
A lot riskier.
Sure, but potentially a lot more profitable in the long run. See, those low-risk bonds that you like so much, they also come with a low reward. Ratings agencies call them investment-grade bonds, and the interest rates they pay are pretty small.
All right, low risk, low reward. That makes sense.
All right, but these high-risk bonds, right, they come with much bigger interest rates to compensate for the danger. Rating agencies call them non-investment-grade or high-yield bonds.
And some people call them junk bonds.
Yes, yeah, some people call them junk bonds, because I guess like a secondhand car part in a car, they can turn out to be junk, and you can end up wasting your money. But if the bond turns out to be a good investment, then because of that high yield, you can make a ton of money. In the same way, if I can find a working transmission for my Saturn for $20 here, as opposed to paying $700 for a new tranny at the GM dealership, then I make out like a bandit.
So high-yield bonds are riskier. They can turn out to be trash, right?
Right, but they're hold high yield for a reason, because they can turn out to be treasure. One man's junkyard is another man's jewel box, Steve. Yeah,
thanks for that, Patty.
Patty Hirsch is Marketplace's senior producer for personal finance. His whiteboard explainers are online at our website, marketplace.org.
As the new year begins, businesses of all types hope 2012 will be better than last year. But as Andrea Gardner reports, the forecast is mixed for the restaurant industry.
2011 was a flat year for the food service industry. Consumer visits to dine-in restaurants were down about 2%, while fast food restaurants saw slight gains. The market research firm NDP Group studies the restaurant industry and says 2012 should be better. Traffic is expected to grow by about 1%. But that's about as good as it gets, says NDP analyst Bonnie Riggs.
The restaurant industry is not forecast to grow more than 1% a year over the next decade.
But Riggs says some types of food service should do better than that. One example is fast casual restaurants, which provide healthier options than fast food, but are less expensive than sit-down restaurants. I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace.
Finally today, Stacey, a North Carolina man was arrested last week. He was trying to buy a vacuum cleaner and a microwave oven and other items with counterfeit money at a Walmart store,
ooh,
which happens. We know that happens, right?
Well,
He offered the cashier a $1 million bill.
I think you have to aim lower if you're counterfeiting money.
$1 million.
I feel like that's...
the bill didn't even have a president or any Secretary of Treasury.
What
Secretary
was on
State,
it?
Had the Statue of Liberty.
Well, okay,
on the front of it, in the little, the oval. And then I'm trying to think of what was on. I think Mount Rushmore was on the back. I'm not absolutely sure. Yeah.
It was $1 million bill.
$1 million bill.
Wow.
Well, no. All right. So here, there are a couple of problems at work here. Besides the issue
of
getting change, there is no change. Who has $999+1,000 in the Walmart?
I don't even think banks have that much.
Drawer. Yeah, exactly. And number two, the U.S. Treasury has never produced a bill that was $1 million.
Really?
They've never. No. The largest bill in circulation right now is $100. That's the largest. At one time, the U.S. Treasury did print 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, and I believe they even went back in the 30s. They went up to 100,000. But that was it. That was as far as they went, was 100,000 way back when.
No million-dollar bills.
I even think that's when we were on the gold standard way back when. Yeah. So just because a bill doesn't exist, though, Stacey, doesn't mean people will stop trying to pass it along. In 2004, if you can believe it, at a Walmart in Georgia, a woman tried to use $1 million bill. She tried
really?
To do the same thing.
So the guy
yes.
couldn't even claim that he was being original?
No, he wasn't. He was a copycat. He was a copycat counterfeiter is what he was. A few years earlier in Kentucky, a Dairy Queen cashier accepted a $200 bill. No such thing again. $200 bill from a customer ordering an ice cream sundae.
But it got accepted.
Got accepted. The bill had a picture of George W. Bush on it.
Oh, really?
The sitting president at the time. He was the president. I think this happened in 2001. The cashier did give him $198 in change.
So sometimes crime does pay. That's our lesson for today.
Let's not go with that. I don't like that moral.
We're going to get letters.
In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year, Steve. And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.